Hello, and welcome to DocTales, the podcast where I get to interview my dad about his lifelong adventures as a doctor in Israel and all around the world. I'm Yoni Alkin.
And I'm Dr. Michael Alkin.
And he's here to tell you, in his own voice, his DocTales. I wanted to start with this tale since it gets the ball rolling on telling my dad's life story. While the episodes are not going in chronological order, with each adventure, the picture gets more and more clear, and you'll slowly see how they all connect. Today, we're going to talk about my dad's experience in the Suez Canal in 1969, during the War of Attrition. Let's get started. So, one of the things that I've always wanted to ask you about is I always wanted to hear a little bit more about your military service. Now, I'm going to explain a little bit about Israeli military service because not everyone who's listening may be Israeli, and for us it's very much a given. It's obvious what's going on and what does it mean, military service, but for many it isn't. So I'll give kind of like a general explanation about what is the Israeli mandatory military service. So every Israeli, when they reach 18, the age of 18, they serve for 2 or 3 years. And this has changed throughout the years. And that's their mandatory service. However, there is such a thing called atuda, which basically means that you can, before your service, before you start your mandatory service, the army sends you to the university, sends you to college, and basically you do your undergrad, and the military pays for it. Do you wanna intersect? Do you wanna say something?
First of all, I want to emphasize that it's the he and the she who go to the army. And it is not paid by the military. The studies are not paid by the army. What happens is that you defer the military service, kind of an agreement between you and the army that you first go and study, particularly if you're going to study something that is of interest to the army, and then you serve your 3 years as a male or 2 years as a woman. That is the norm for deferring your service. And this is actually what happened to me. I went to medical school at the ripe age of 18, and I was practically recruited into the army when I was 24, 25.
Uh-huh. So first of all, that's awesome. You know, I didn't know that. I thought that the military pays for that. And yeah, you went to medical school at such a young age for an Israeli guy, but it's pretty common to go to medical school. I mean, to start your studies at 18, not in Israel. So basically your mandatory service gets deferred, and then you sign on extra years and, well, you start to get paid a decent amount as opposed to your mandatory service. And you basically stay in the military for several years, and it depends on what you study, for how long you stayed. And you specifically stayed for longer. You stayed until you were a lieutenant colonel, if I remember correctly.
Yes. This is actually the story that I will tell today about how it came to be that I became a professional officer in the Israeli army for 20 years.
Yeah. Tell us, maybe, do you want to, I was thinking if you want to go over your military service, but like in general, like a quick run, but it's 20 years. So maybe you, if you just want to go into your military service until the story that you want to tell today.
Yeah, I did my compulsory military service as a doctor in a field unit. First, it was a paratroopers unit, and then later it was a brigade. I was the medical officer for the brigade. And as part of the deal with the military, I was ready to be discharged and start my residency in internal medicine. So it was really a time of change when I was asked, I would even say as a going away present, to substitute for a doctor on one of the posts at the Suez Canal. Now, this needs a little bit of introduction. Israel was holding the peninsula of the Sinai, which was larger than Israel proper, since 1967, when it was taken from the Egyptians during the Six-Day War. And we were holding the line on the Suez Canal, right at the waterfront, in very sophisticated dugouts, which were built using old railroad tracks. The iron was our protection. Our roofs were made as a line of railroad tracks. And above that was about 2 yards of earth, which was further protection against direct hits. Mm-hmm. After 1967, for years, there was skirmishes along the canal, some weeks more, some weeks less, and it was an ongoing war of attrition between Israel and Egypt, which really didn't find its place in the history of Israel as one of the important wars, in spite of the fact that it was bleeding all the time. It was fought by the regular army and people who were doing their monthly service
reserves
as reserve soldiers and officers, plus a relatively large group of volunteers who volunteered to be commanders of one of those strong posts along the canal.
Hmm. So let me just give another explanation that when you finish your mandatory service, you are still in reserves for many years after. So you're saying that basically those outposts were personnelled by reserves and by regular mandatory service soldiers and some volunteers. Could you give an example of what a skirmish would look like? Is it just shelling? Is it actual soldiers trying to cross the border? What would that look like?
All of the above and more. Usually it was shelling. And the width of a canal at the area where I was is about 400 yards, 400 meters. It is too close for comfort. It is within the range of a sniper. It is definitely within the range of small mortars, larger mortars, cannon. And shelling was a daily affair. Along the canal, there was a road which was shot at often. So moving in and out of the strongholds of the posts along the canal was an adventure. So I was about to be discharged from my military service. I was about to start working at Hadassah in Jerusalem.
The hospital, yes.
At the hospital. We were newlywed. And we rented a studio apartment in an older part of Jerusalem, which was defined by my father as sehr romantisch, very romantic, because it was very small and cozy. And just before I left for this week of replacing a doctor at one of the posts, I cooked for my newlywed wife and filled the fridge with food. so that she has enough for the week of my absence, which was my response to being scared that something bad might happen. And I really don't remember anything from how I got down, which vehicle, who saw to it that I get to the post. I don't remember that. What I remember is the place I have very vivid memory of. Imagine a circular yard with openings of like holes on the sides. Around the yard, there was a ramp of earth, which was semicircular facing the canal, which was the front line.
Right.
Into this ramp were the dugouts in which we lived. As I mentioned, they were covered with railroad tracks, and I mentioned railroad tracks over and over again because this was the railway that went from west, from the western desert through Egypt to Palestine and then on to Damascus, built by built for the Turks by the Germans in the last days of the Ottoman Empire, and rebuilt by the British during World War II. And it was this railway line which brought my father home from his military service for vacations.
Now you're talking about World War II, which which we'll talk about at another time, I'm sure.
Yes, but having the railway tracks that brought my father home as my roof and cover and protection was quite emotional at the time. The dugouts were a series of tunnels with rooms opening. In the rooms, there were bunks, two or three tiers, and that's where we lived. There was no way of cooking inside, so there was a kitchen in the yard, in the open, and the cook was always busy until a whistle was sound, which was a warning that shelling starts. The cook and everybody else who was sunbathing or doing hanging washings or whatever, we all ran into our foxholes as if this was World War One. It was really a surreal scene. The soldiers who were there, there was a basic infantry unit of about 20 men, maybe 30, who were watching, who were alarming, who were actually sniping at the Egyptians on the other side every now and then.
Right.
Directing mortar fire. They were the soldiers. And then there was all the auxiliaries, like a radio operator, a cook, a doctor.
Right.
Some medics who didn't know each other.
Ah.
So there was the organic group of infantry soldiers, and then there were the auxiliary assistants who did the everyday jobs.
Right.
One of the big issues there was the chemical toilets, which were in a corner of the yard. They were a place you don't want to go to because of the smell, because they were small, and once you closed the door, you were really fried.
You mean heat-wise?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is the desert, the Sinai Desert.
That sounds very very uncomfortable. And a place, like you said, that you would avoid. I can't imagine also what would happen if you're there and all of a sudden there's a shelling or an attack.
You're right. You're right. So here was my response. I told the commander of the post that I'm going to relieve myself and it's going to be way out in the desert and I don't want to be disturbed. I took my personal arms, uh-huh. which was a Uzi submachine gun,
uh-huh.
and started walking outside. Now, this area of the northern part of the canal is actually a kind of desert which is covered with salt crystals.
Mm.
It is a salt plain. So it is white, it is shiny, it is hot, and it crushes under your boots. So the further I walked, the more quiet it became, and the only disturbance to total silence was the sound of my boots on the salt crystals crushing. And when I was far enough, I decided that this is a good spot, which looked like everything else around me, because it was wide open and very flat. And I kneeled down naked and looked at the outpost. And there it was, you know, a little bump on the horizon,
mm-hmm.
a little bit of nothing. I couldn't even see the canal. I couldn't see the road. All I could see was salt crystals shining into my eyes. And it was a moment of bliss. It was a moment of total commitment to one deed. And it was quiet. It was quiet. I didn't need to talk to anybody. And I was there. And hell broke loose.
Oh, no.
I saw how my home was being intensely shelled.
Mm.
There was a cloud of smoke and dust coming up from the yard. There were direct hits on the yard.
And you were far enough away.
Oh, yeah, I was far. I was completely safe.
Mm-hmm.
And I put my pants on. And said to myself, am I going back? Am I staying away? What should I do? And I started walking back very slowly. And the shelling stopped. And when I got back to the yard, the whole place was full of half-baked potato chips.
Because
the cook was baking potato chips for everybody in... And the hot oil was on the ground around the fire. And
oh my.
The place was really like after war, you know.
Right. Well, it is. Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
And we were laughing and we were happy that we were all okay and nobody was scratched.
Oh, good.
It was fine. And it was actually my last day and I started, you know, packing my small gear. And up comes the convoy of the new doctor, the new radio man, probably the new cook as well.
Your replacement.
Not only ours, but replacements along the whole line. And that's why it was a convoy of what used to be called by the British half tracks, which is a vehicle which is two front tires and chains in the back.
Mm. Like a tank chains.
Yes. And it is a vehicle from hell. It really is very uncomfortable.
Mm.
But it gives you a feeling of safety because the sides are thick iron plates and you think you're safe.
Right. It's a version of an APC, basically, Armored Personnel Carrier.
Yeah, it's an old version. I think this was made in World War II by the British.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So in comes the convoy, and the commander of the convoy is screaming at the top of his voice, everybody in There's going to be more shelling. Be quick. The doctor jumps off, and we have enough time while the convoy is continuing to the northern end of the canal to chat and transfer all the information, mm-hmm. make him aware of the equipment, medical equipment, talk to the new medics who came with him. And we had a few hours.
Oh, good.
And it was tense, but it was okay. And back comes the convoy, and now it is dark, and everybody feels that in the dark we can sneak out and never see this post again.
Right.
About 15 minutes into the travel from the post, there was a tremendous burst of anti-tank cannon fire, and one of the half-tracks started to burn. Everybody jumped off. We were about 50, 60 people. We all hid behind a sand dune, and the commander of the convoy, who didn't know any of the soldiers, was really very clear and said, "We're not going to continue this way. They have infrared sights. They see every single move of ours. We're going to walk home." And he organized the whole convoy in a shape of a square where there are three people with compasses up front and a map. This is before the days of GPS or anything like that. In the middle, everybody, and then the fighters were in the rear, armed, watching the rear, watching that we don't lose anybody, watching that nobody comes behind us. And there was a feeling of a herd. Mm-hmm. Right behind the three scouts was the commanding officer. Very calm. He was a man I knew before. He was a lieutenant colonel whom I knew years ago, and I didn't even go up to him and present myself. He said, "Is there a doctor?" I said, "Yep," and that was it, because this was a no-nonsense moment.
Right.
And we started walking. There was no moon, but the commander with the map in his hand and the three scouts in front with the compass were walking through the sand dunes and the salt plain, and more sand dunes. And this way we spent the whole night. Every now and then he would shout, "A break," and then we would sit and wait and catch our breath. There was very little water, and we shared. And there was a feeling that nothing will happen to us, that we're okay, that this lieutenant colonel is going to save our lives, and he's taking us to the big base of Baluza, which is a very interesting place, but that's beyond the story. It is actually built next to the remains of a Roman city by the name of Pelusion, which remained in the Arab version of Baluza.
Ah, interesting.
So we were walking in the desert for the whole night. First dawn, we surprised the guards at the gate of the base, coming from the wrong direction, from the naked desert, you know, not from any road.
Not from the road, yeah.
And everyone was drinking water, resting, and in comes a taxi cab. And it had its rear seat folded over because it was packed with the morning newspapers, brought from the printing house in Tel Aviv.
Right.
And I walk up to the cab driver and I say, "Are you going back to Tel Aviv?" He said, "Yes, I am." I said, "Can I catch a ride with you?" "Sure thing," he said. "I'll fold over the seat. I said, "Don't bother. I'll lie on the floor of the car. I need sleep."
Yeah.
I was fast asleep, and he woke me up at the outskirts of Tel Aviv, asking me where I want to get off. And he actually let me off at crossroads very close to the headquarters of the medical corps, where the chief surgeon had his office and everybody else was commanding the whole medical operation of the army.
Right.
And I walk into the offices, and the first office is manpower, HR. And I stand in front of the door, and I bash in, and I said, "Where do you sign on for military service?"
Huh.
And the major, who knew all the doctors, he could recite your serial military number by heart. And I walk in and he says, 457-123 Alkan, what can I do for you? And I said, I want to sign on. And he said, for how long do you want to sign on? I said, what does everybody else do? And he says, everybody else signs on for 7 years, 5 years hospital work and 2 years field work. Does that sound right? I said, yeah, bring me the forms and I'll sign. And the feeling was, I cannot abandon my friends, my pals. And it was a direct response to this night hike, which took us from hell back to normal. And after signing all the papers, I walk on, and the chief surgeon of the army, who knew me, comes out of his office and says, I understand it is goodbye, Alkan, you're leaving the service. And I said, I just signed on for 7 years. What? He says, people are negotiating and haggling with me for weeks before they sign, and you first sign and then you come to tell me? I said, What are the conditions? What do I need to do next? And he says, go find a place for residency. We'll talk later. And that's how I signed on and then continued to sign on until I was discharged 18 years later as a lieutenant colonel with quite a lot of military experience. Of course, from there, I hitchhiked to Jerusalem, back to my newlywed wife, and everything else was just milk and honey.
Wow, how incredible. It's so difficult for me to put myself in that position of, you know, today people look for work, they find a job, they switch jobs after 2 years, they try to go to school and they finish their studies, and oh, maybe I'll go and try this for a little while, and everything is up in the air and takes a lot of thinking and deliberation and checking things out. And you were basically having that emotional drive and the strength of a mission in your heart that was basically, this is where I need to be and this is what I need to do.
There is a caveat there. Yes, everything you said is true, but there is a caveat. And the difference between your generation and mine is that in my time, tenure, in Hebrew, kviut, which literally translated means permanency.
And stagnation, but yes.
yes, was a goal on the horizon for which you were willing to sacrifice everything. And our whole career development was much more paved and cleared and understood from the word go.
Right.
So the fact that I went and found a place for residency in internal medicine was actually the vector that was supposed to take me all the way to till I retire.
Which it kind of did, in a sense.
In a way it did, yes. With some convolutions, of course.
Sure.
But the basic idea was that once you decide on a track, you go for it, and you make every effort, including misunderstandings with your boss, including unhappy days at work, including suffering endlessly from meager pay, all kinds of difficulties which are come with the with developing a career. All of these were taken with a grain of salt because you were striving for tenure. Because once you got tenure, you can't be fired. Mm-hmm. Let's say you can't be fired easily.
Right, right. You have to do something egregious.
And when I look at your generation, as you described it so well, it's a completely different world.
Yeah.
With much more open options, with a lot of flexibility, and taking more risks than we ever did professionally.
Absolutely. And it's really interesting. We've had this discussion privately quite a few times, and just imagining your life and knowing from the age of 18 until today that you're 80, that you're going to be a doctor and you're going to just do doctoring for your whole life. I've had, I'm going to say, 5 careers in my lifetime, and I'm still trying to figure it out.
You're not done yet.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's just so, such a, I envy you in a sense because of that stability.
But, you know, the thread on which all the life events are hanging is being a doctor.
Right.
It really is a way of life for me.
Yeah.
Be it on the Suez Canal, or be it at the Hadassah Hospital, or be it now in the clinics that I volunteer at, I'm a doctor.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I go on a mission, people ask, what did you do there? I said, what did I do there? There's only one thing I know how to do. I was a doctor.
Right. Yeah, which I'll challenge that, but yes, you know more than being a doctor, but yes.
Yeah.
And I gotta also say that you went into that office and signed off for 7 years of your life, which ended up being more than seven. You were, what, 24?
No, this is 25 plus 2.5.
I was 27.
Almost 28.
28. Yes. Yeah. The age of, first of all, that's amazing that, you know, sorry, I'm not meaning to make fun of you. I'm just flabbergasted that with an established prefrontal cortex, you were still able to go in and say, I'm signing off 7 years of my life. To me, that's really hard to grasp. But it's beautiful. It's amazing.
You know, when I think about it now, what amazes me is that I never, the thought of sharing with my newlywed wife the plans for the next 7 years, this never passed my mind. That to me now, thinking about it, is absolutely amazing, you know. Yeah. Because now I would put my hand in my pocket, get my mobile phone out, sit under a tree in the yard and say, Yardena, what do you think? I want to sign on. I think it is important. Please support me, you know. Or what is your take on this? And she probably would have said, it's your decision. You decide, you do. It's okay. But I can't even imagine not sharing right away before I sign, or maybe right after, and it's still when the ink hasn't dried yet.
You can still tear up the forms.
Yep.
Wow. Yeah, absolutely. You've mentioned the lieutenant colonel that led you on that march. Is he someone that is important in your history and Israel's history, or is he someone?
Okay. I can say his name. It is not a secret. Yaakov Chisdai was raised as Bachur Yeshiva, as a scholar of Jewish studies and a religious man. In the best sense of the word. He was not the type of secluded religious, but the type of pioneer religious who always thought of the people in the country first and then his personal views and beliefs.
Right.
He became a major general. He was a scholar. He studied history. And he became the coordinator of the committee that studied and criticized the Yom Kippur War of 1973 as a professional officer. And unfortunately, he then tried to go into politics. Mm-hmm. He even was a member of parliament for a very short time. And then sank into the abyss of honest politicians.
Oh no! Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah,
those don't last.
I was never heard of again.
Right.
Yeah, and his leadership that night was absolutely amazing, absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, I would guess that was a part of what made you sign his leadership, him specifically.
It was the kinship of this group of soldiers that didn't know each other, who all of a sudden were thrown into kinship and brotherhood for one night. And you feel you don't want to abandon them.
Yeah, they say brothers in arms, right? They are. It is a kinship.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And we were all carrying relatively heavy loads because we had our personal gear and our military gear. I had a big doctor's backpack on my back, and in the front I had my knapsack with my dirty underwear. So it was an effort, I would say.
Yeah. Could you estimate like how much of a distance did you march?
Somewhere between 25 and 30 kilometers.
Okay. Yeah.
It's a night's march.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's in the desert. Even though it's nighttime and not warm, it's still...
It wasn't blazing hot, but we were all sweating.
For sure. You've mentioned so many beautiful small moments from this experience, but is there something that sticks out to you emotionally, or something that you mentioned that you remember the post very well? Is there something in it that you might want to share about it?
I was hoping you'll never ask. You see, the whole experience was about 8 or 9 days. And there are parts of it which I will never, ever forget. And one of them is on the second or third day, our dugout was invaded by four Navy SEALs.
Wow.
Four frogmen who were preparing for some activity across the canal.
Sorry, I got confused. You mean invaded by our Navy SEALs?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But all of a sudden, instead of being a doctor and three medics on the bunks, we were seven people.
Right.
Or eight. And they had to be distributed in different foxholes because there was not enough room for all of them.
Right.
The commanding officer, a huge red-haired, pink-skinned man, came and said, "I don't need a bunk. I will spread my sleeping bag here on the floor."
Mm-hmm.
And he came in with a huge bag of all the equipment that he needed. You know, the wetsuit and the goggles and God knows what else. Arms, whatever. And we chatted for the afternoon, And he was very, very quiet, a huge man. And he had this captivating smile, you know, that don't worry, everything will be okay. And he had this slogan of Hakol Tov,
everything's good.
And after dark, the four of them disappeared, leaving behind their uniforms and their personal belongings, and being off with the military equipment and into the water.
Right.
They never came back. Mm. 2 days later, a Navy officer came to collect the personal items.
Yeah.
And I still see in front of my eyes this huge man in his underwear lying on his sleeping bag trying to read a book on the floor of my dugout. Yeah. I never dared to ask what happened.
Of course.
I don't know his name. I don't know anything. And at the time, I should not have known, because their mission was top secret, and we shouldn't have known. But later on, I never dared to find out.
Yeah.
And so it stays in my memory as a story with no closure.
Exactly. Yeah. And I thank you. Thank you for sharing that. I'm thinking about you saying there's this man in my foxhole. And I'm thinking you arrived in that foxhole 2-3 days before that. And how...
That's so typical for the military.
Right. And so everything is transient and has incredible significance.
Yes, yes. There is a fine mixture of estrangement and brotherhood.
Mm. Yeah, you've said it. Wow. Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing that. And these are stories that I've never heard before. So thank you so much.
Yeah. Yeah, don't forget, we're talking about 1969, so it's a long, long time ago.
It's 10 years before I was born, so.
yeah, right.
Thank you so much for joining us on this adventure. This show was recorded and edited by me, Yoni Alkin, and it would not be made possible without the wonderful help of my brother, Shai Alkin. The music you're hearing right now and in the beginning is by the awesome Jefferson Berge, and you can find more about us at doctales.org. I hope you join us again here at DocTales, and in the meanwhile, take care of yourself and take care of somebody else.